The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to a great, great night. For a great, great lady. Every time I get ready to, I'm going to read it because I'll break down and cry because I love Sister Alice so very much. What an honor to introduce our dear Sister Alice Walker tonight. So listen. Listen, gentle persons. She comes to you this evening with two voices, the voice of the praiser, praising all the good that we do, and the voice of the poet, a weaver of words, threading silver and gold into our veins. So listen, listen, gentle persons. Pull your hearts out of your armpits. Get your tuxedos out of mothballs. Put your long red dress on, girl, and snap your breasts into place. As we go sailing on her tongue, loving, living, learning to speak without a crutch. Someone said, there is a dance in each one of us. I would say there is also moon, prayer, rain, ash, and river, a river of castanets, feeling the pulse of our dear Sister Alice, our practicing American saint who broke one day into a dance of butterflies. Winging in and out of our American dream, hanging bamboo laughter, lighting our campuses, our hallways, our streets, our homes, our country, our world, our eyes, our memory against peacock catastrophes. This is an introduction, I think, about a woman whose hands discovered life through helping the uninitiated. Hands wrapped in wrists as she reaches out to humankind, and she holds her hands out to you and to me, her hands with no eyes, her hands with no nostrils, her hands with no ears. Now she dresses them up like a musician so they can see you home, so they can accompany you as you move, surrounded by the voices of your ancestors. In this soft evening air, as the world holds us all in a single breath, she sings, will you let us in, America? It is time for young words, ideas, new visions. She sings, today is Wednesday. Let us wash the feet of our country. Let us sanitize the walls of the world with environmental justice, peace, racial, social, economic, religious, and sexual justice. She sings, let us anoint our hands with light as we walk towards ourselves and find others just like us. She sings, a memory of eyes calling out, her eyes, morning stars opening up the world as she creates new dreams, alarming the death singers that we have come to celebrate life, 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 life. And the day disrobes in prayer, and the day disrobes in prayer for this woman who walks on rivers, for this woman whose words carry the spirit of creation. Indichia, 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 you woman close to the ancestors. I give you Alice Walker.
I'm a little taller than Sonia. And she is very, very tall. I'm very happy to see all of you. It's a wonderful evening to be in this city, which I know of, unfortunately, through so many of your disasters. But I was thinking, looking at the fountains, there's a little one you have for the children and a bigger one for the adults. I was thinking, well, you know, where water flows, so can peace. And so the history that is so vivid for me of the bombing of the MOVE people, of the imprisonment of Mumia, that history is not the whole story. And it's very good to remember that and to see that we make our way every day, every single step can be a different direction. So as I was thinking about what I wanted to talk about and read about, and I don't have a whole lot of time, but I wanted to start by mentioning something that I find very disturbing, which is that, you know, our country, and, you know, we're not alone. This country's not the only country making a lot of war in the world, but we're making some really terrible big ones. And we, you know, bomb and shoot these people over generations, starve them, you know, have blockades. Cuba, for instance, Iran, other places in the world. And then when we have someone in, quote, leadership who says, well, you know, we'll start a slow withdrawal, and we start thinking, oh, well, the war's over. Well, I was reading, or maybe I heard this somewhere, and this is just something for us to meditate about, that the children in El Salvador, I believe, where the war went on forever and will never end, really, the children have been left so impoverished that they can no longer eat without having pain in their teeth. Because what has the war left them with? The war has left them with toothache forever. This is what war does. It isn't just that when you stop shooting people, bombing their houses and, you know, destroying everything, that you somehow that they're going to be okay. They're not. So I wanted to start there and also to go on to these two new books. Now, I have been trying for, I guess, the last 20-something years to stop writing books. And I keep, you know, I totally get it that I work for the ancestors. And I sometimes will feel very free. You know, I finished something. I remember finishing The Color Purple 30 years ago and just weeping in joy. You know, okay, you know, I'm done. And I have had that scenario with myself many times, thinking I'm done. But anyhow, so this book, I'm going to read first from The Cushion in the Road. And I wanted to read a little bit about how that came about. How did I come to think of the life that I lead, which is very, when I'm not, you know, on the road somewhere, it's so quiet, it's so meditative, it's so contemplative, it is so happy with me and my sweetheart, who is a musician. One of the ironies of life, of course, is that I love quiet so much that I fell in love with the person who plays trumpet. And so, you know, life, I'm sure it's the same with you. Life is always just, you know, telling us, who do you think is in charge? Did you, by some dream, did you imagine that you are in charge? Well, I'll just show you. So this is a very short introduction to this book, The Cushion in the Road. I have learned much from Taoist thought. It has been a comfort to me since I read my first Taoist poem, which was sitting quietly, doing nothing, spring comes, and the grass grows by itself. To me, this is a perfect poem. But there is also from that tradition this thought, a wanderer's home is in the road. A wanderer's home is in the road. This has proved very true in my own life, much to my surprise, because I am such a homebody. I love being home with my plants, animals, sunrises and sunsets, the moon. It is all glorious to me. And so when I turned 60, I was prepared to bring all of myself to sit on my cushion in a meditation room I had prepared long ago and never get up. It so happened that I was in South Korea that year, of course, and South Koreans agreed with me. In fact, in that culture, it is understood that when we turn 60, we become eggy. It sounds like eggy, though perhaps this is not how Koreans spell it. And this means we are free to become, once again, like a child. We are to rid ourselves of our cares, especially those we have collected in the world, and to turn inward to a life of ease, of leisure, of joy. I loved hearing this. What an affirmation of a feeling I was already beginning to have. Enough of the world. Where is the grandchild? Where is the cushion? And so I began to prepare myself to withdraw from the worldly fray. There I sat finally on a cushion in Mexico with a splendid view of a homemade stone fountain with its softly falling water, a perfect soothing backdrop to what I thought would be the next and perhaps final 20 years of my life. Unlike my great-great-great-great-grandmother who lived to be 125, I figure 80 is doing really well. And then a miracle seemed to be happening. America was about to elect or not elect a person of color as its president. What? My cushion shifted minutely. Then, too, an unsuspecting guest left the radio on, and I learned that bombs were falling on the people of Gaza. A mother, unconscious herself, had lost 5 of her daughters. Didn't I have a daughter? Would I have wanted to lose her in this way? Wasn't I a mother, even if reportedly imperfect in that role? Well, my cushion began to wobble. I had friends who became eggy and managed to stay eggy. I envied them. For me, the years following my 60th birthday seemed to be about teaching me something else, that yes, I could become like a child again and enjoy all the pleasures of wonder a child experiences. But I would have to attempt to maintain this joy in the vicissitudes of the actual world, as opposed to the meditative universe I had created with its calming, ever-flowing fountain. My travels would take me to the celebrations in Washington, D.C., where our new president, Barack Obama, would be inaugurated. They would carry me the morning after those festivities to faraway Burma, Myanmar, which would lead to much writing about Aung San Suu Kyi. They would take me to Thailand for a lovely trip up a long river where I could wave happily at the people who smiled back when smiled upon. They would take me to Gaza, yes, and much writing about the Palestine-Israel impasse. To the West Bank, to India, to all kinds of amazing places. Like, for instance, Petra in Jordan. Who knew? I would find myself raising a nation of chickens in between travels and visits to holy people in Kerala, Oakland, Woodacre, and Dharamsala. My cushion, the fountain, the peace, because of my attention to some of the deep suffering in the world, sometimes seemed far away. I felt torn, a condition I do not like and do not recommend. And then, in a dream, it came to me. There was a long asphalt highway like the one that passed by my grandparents' place when I lived with them as an 8- and 9-year-old. My grandfather and I would sit on the porch in the still Georgia heat and count the cars as they whizzed by. He'd choose red cars. I would choose blue or black. It was a sitting on cushions of sorts, I suppose, for the two of us, because hours could go by, and we were perfectly content. Perhaps that is why, in the dream, the solution to my quandary was available. There, in the middle of the long, perfectly straight highway, with its slightly faded yellow center line that I had known and loved as a child, sat my rose-colored meditation cushion, directly on the yellow line, right in the middle of the road. So what do I believe? That I was born to wander, and I was born to sit. To love home with a sometimes almost unbearable affection, but to be lured out into the world to see how it is doing as my beloved larger home and paradise. So in my kitchen for many years, I have been supported by all the photographs and sayings and poetry of people. And recently I decided to take down most of it because it had been there so long. The edges were curling and the paper was turning yellow. But when I came to this quote from Walt Whitman, I could not remove it. And so I'll read it to you because one of the things that's so lovely about having a history in a place is to have poets who have gone before and who have left these wonderful guides to us. And you probably know this quote. This is what you shall do. Love the earth and the sun and the animals. Love the earth and the sun and the animals. Despise riches. There I disagree with him. I think it should be share riches. Give alms to everyone that asks. Stand up for the stupid and crazy. Now, I love that part. Stand up for the stupid and crazy. Now, really, this will test us. But it has to be done. You have to stand up for them and to them. Devote your income and labor to others and to yourself. You're deserving. Hate tyrants, really. You know, the tyrants, I don't know if hating them is going to change them. It doesn't seem to have worked very well. Anyway, you can hate tyranny. Argue not concerning God. Now, there is an argument you have to agree that is futile. You know, really. Looking deeply, peering closely. Have patience and indulgence toward the people. Now, that is also a tall order, especially in hot weather. Have patience and indulgence toward the people. Take off your hat to nothing known or unknown, or to any man or number of men. Go freely with powerful, uneducated people, and with the young and with the mothers of families. Read these leaves in the open air every season and every year of your life. Re-examine all you have been told at school or church or in any book. Re-examine it. Dismiss whatever insults your own soul. Dismiss it. And your very flesh shall be a great poem. Hallelujah. Hallelujah. I want to read you something called Ending the Age of Waste. Now, in this time, we always wonder about what is the most crucial thing to do. In one of these essays, I say that to me, the most crucial thing that we can do is regain our health. And then the second most crucial thing to do is to help other people regain theirs. Because if we are a healthy people, we are less easily led in destructive ways, and we are so much less gullible, and we're so much more clear-headed and awake. In fact, we were visiting just last night a friend who has a little dog named Duke. And every time we visited these friends before, old Duke was just sleeping on his cushion. You know, just sleeping, not meditating, sleeping. And, you know, just fat and lazy and, you know, all kind of. And then Duke's people put him on a diet. And the entire time we saw Duke last evening, Duke was just bouncing all over the place, bright-eyed, happy, you know, full of himself. And that is the way it can be with us. So, but anyway, in this particular piece, I'm saying something else. The most important thing humanity can do is believe in itself. And I do believe this is true. I think we are in such danger of not believing in ourselves because we've gone so far. We've lost so much of what we thought was good, what we thought was possible, what we thought was right. The most important thing humanity can do is believe in itself, that we can grow, that we can change, and that we can rouse ourselves to exhibit gratitude. Gratitude is what makes us wealthy. By respecting her limits to the only planet mother we have ever known. Gratitude to the only planet mother we have ever known. Until I was a teenager, I had no experience of waste. Growing up on a farm in Middle Georgia, everything we grew, built, raised, or sowed was used until it was used up. There was no extra. And no such thing as litter. My parents were puzzled when they perceived the beginning in their community, among their relatives and friends, among their children, of, quote, the age of waste. Neither of them knew what to do, for example, with styrofoam containers or plastic cups. They thought items so wondrously made, so lightweight and sturdy, should certainly be prized. They carefully washed and reused them until their replacements began to appear at an alarming rate. For a long time, they could, now isn't that sweet? I mean, don't you just love my parents? Oh, I mean, just such a dear understanding, you know, of what would become the problem. But anyway, for a long time, they collected and carefully stashed these new inventions in the kitchen pantry, believing, I suppose, that at some point they would come in handy. Now, isn't that, you know, perhaps... I just want to hug them, you know, I just want to hug them. They were so wise. Perhaps they could be used to carry food to picnics. Maybe they'd be useful to share food if someone came to dinner and wanted to take food home. I mean, really, that makes so much sense. How could they know that this plastic, like almost all plastic from that time to this, would end up in the oceans, killing turtles, dolphins, whales, and fish? And presenting major health challenges to humans, all because it was used once, and thrown away. My parents heated their homes, never more than three small rooms and a kitchen, with wood they cut and carried inside themselves until they moved to town where everyone used electric heaters, and in the chilly concrete rooms of the projects, ran them in winter almost all the time, rarely feeling warm, even so. My grandparents were even more frugal than my parents and lacked for a longer time than my parents both electricity and refrigeration. All food was eaten fresh, canned in jars for winter or smoke and or salt cured. In summer, the favorite fruit, watermelon, was kept cool by placing melons under the bed. Oh, a magical place to me as a child for the round, dark, green treasure. You know, I'm going to stop right here and recommend that when you go and buy watermelons, especially those deep green ones, and if you have children, put the melons under the bed for the children to find. It's just absolutely heaven. They had kerosene lamps, which they lit just as darkness fell, until in their late 60s, they also moved to town. They, like my parents, grew everything they ate except for citrus fruit, sugar, salt, and coffee, which they bought in town a few times a year. Like my parents also, they raised pigs and chickens, goats and ducks, and grew gardens of healthy produce that made them some of the best-fed people on earth. They knew nothing of artificial fertilizer, nothing of Monsanto, nothing of pesticide. There was, as I recall, one major infestation of their garden among the tomatoes, giant tomato worms that were carefully picked off the plants by hand. As children, we chased each other around the yard with these worms, truly huge and scary to see, like miniature green dragons. The largest of them even had horns. I was not afraid of them. My sister Ruth was terrified of them, which was really unfortunate for her. What I have learned from these country folk and from my own life is that it is not necessary to be rich or even, quote, well off to be happy. What is essential, though, is to have enough. Much energy might go into educating human beings about just what enough is. As a culture, we in America have rarely seemed to know. Part of this ignorance is because we inherited the consumer-driven capitalist system and paid no attention to the people of indigenous cultures already here, who were more like my parents and grandparents, extremely careful not to waste anything. If my parents and grandparents had had health care that included even a yearly visit to the dentist, and if schools had been well equipped with teachers and with materials, and if work had provided a decent wage, our family would have been content with a happiness that went beyond the mainly peaceful existence we managed to make out of what we did have. Will we need to endure another war on American soil? Of the many wars that have been fought here, it is the Civil War that most think of as war. The, quote, Indian Wars, genocidal wars against the indigenous population, are largely forgotten. But are we to have another war on our soil before we learn what is precious in life? Goddess forbid. And yet, I think of a story a friend of mine told about being in Nicaragua during the Contra War against the Sandinistas. You will recall that the United States backed the Contras, alas. She said one day she watched a member of the embattled Sandinista government stoop down to pick up a paperclip that had dropped onto the floor. Nicaragua had been so impoverished by the war that there seemed nothing one could actually consider office supplies. She could tell by the look on his eyes that the paperclip was cherished. This was the most moving moment in her time of witnessing there. This may well be how it is for us, so wasteful of so much, for so long. But maybe not. Nostradamus' prophecy of all-out nuclear war during this very period, notwithstanding. Perhaps we can learn how to change our course in a way that means that we and all of Earth's resources will not be consumed in war. War, which is perhaps the most blatantly unintelligent and unproductive activity that humans are engaged in. Of course, there are others. A general waste of Earth's resources constituting a major and unwinnable war. Unwinnable war, not only against our common mother, but against ourselves. The planet is fed up, The planet is tired of us. My friend Bill Wapapa, of Lakota and Kickapoo ancestry, used to come to my house exhausted from speaking up for Mother Earth, and would collapse on a bed in my guest studio, always sprinkling tobacco in honor of her, and saying to us, "Mother Earth is so tired, so weary, so disrespected and ravaged, I can hardly bear her suffering." Sometimes in his sorrow, he would weep. It always felt as if he were talking about his very best friend as well as of his mother. He was. He died talking and singing and drumming to her, praying on top of mesas where corporations were strip mining coal, or chanting beside pristine rivers soon to be polluted from every conceivable contamination caused by drilling, mining, fracking, and other grotesque forms of ecological rape. He was always thinking of her, always in prayerful alignment. He was her son. He did not forget this for a moment. We must all learn to know her as Bill Wapapa did, to feel with her, to know she is alive, that she is alive and needing affection, caring, love, that she gives us everything. Who are we to give her nothing but basically grief? Massive amounts of faith will be required that we can change enough to be worthy of her caring for us all these millions of years. All these millions of years caring for us. There is a bit of comfort in knowing that, having done all that we can, if we must go down, we will go down together in heartfelt alignment. Earth Mother and her earthling children, hand in hand, doing our best to save each other from a fate that, unfortunately for us humans, is all too easily, without a drastic change of course, foreseen, and is already in so many parts of the world apparent. I want to, I understand I don't have all the time in the world, but I wanted to read you a poem, if I can find it. It just came to me, called "What Do I Get for Getting Old?" And, wait, here it is. "What Do I Get for Getting Old?" 72. I really like this poem because, you know, one of the problems with you know, there's so many things. You can just sort of plug in anywhere. But the whole idea of being afraid of getting old, even though you don't want to die, is so bizarre, you know. I mean, would you rather just die and not get old? "What Do I Get for Getting Old? A Picture Story for the Curious." Uh-oh. How much more time?
As long as it takes to read this poem and the next one.
Okay. In that case, I'm going to read some short ones. Okay, wait. Okay. Okay, thank you. "What Do I Get for Getting Old? A Picture Story for the Curious." You supply the pictures. "I get to meditate in a chair." Now, how many meditators are out there? Because you know you have to, well, in the ideal scenario, you sit on a cushion, you cross your legs, you know, and you do the whole thing, and you have to be really correct, right? Well, when you get old, you can meditate in a chair. "I get to meditate in a chair or against the wall with my legs stretched out." That's really bad news if you go to a meditation center. Oh, or even in bed. They really don't think that's good, but when you get old, you can do that. "I get to see maybe half of what I'm looking at." This changes everything. I get to dance like the tipsy old men I adored when I was an infant. They never dropped me. I get to spend time with myself whenever I want. I get to ride a bicycle with tall handlebars. My posture improves. I get to give up learning to sail. I get to know I will never speak German. I get to snuggle all morning with my snuggler of choice, counting the hours by how many times we get up to pee. I get to spend time with myself whenever I want. I get to eat chocolate with my salad or even as a first course. I get to forget. I get to paint with colors I mix myself, colors I've never seen before. I get to sleep with my dog and pray never to outlive my cat. I get to play music without reading a note. I get to spend time with myself whenever I want. I get to sleep in a hammock under the same stars wherever I am. I get to spend time with myself whenever I want. I get to laugh at all the things I don't know and cannot find. I get to greet people I don't remember as if I know them very well. After all, how different can they be? I get to grow my entire garden in a few pots. I get to spend time with myself whenever I want. I get to see and feel the suffering of the whole world and to take a nap when I feel like it anyway. I get to spend time with myself whenever I want. I get to feel more love than I ever thought existed. Everything appears to be made of the stuff. I feel this especially for you, though I may not remember exactly which you are. How cool is this? Still, I get to spend time with myself whenever I want. And that is just a taste, as the old people used to say down in Georgia when I was a child, of what you get for getting old. Reminding us, as they witnessed our curiosity about them, that no matter the losses, there's something fabulous going on at every stage of life. Something to let go of, maybe, but for darn sure, something to get. That's sweet. Okay, this is the last one. This is a poem about recognizing that sin is actually a part of the discipline that makes us who we become, that there's no such thing as living without it. And we might as well, accept that and work with it. And by doing that, we can grow a lot. So, this is called Hope to Sin Only in the Service of Waking Up. Hope never to believe it is your duty or right to harm another simply because you mistakenly believe they are not you. Hope to understand suffering as the hard assignment, even in school, you wish to avoid but could not. Hope to be imperfect in all the ways that keep you growing. Hope never to see another, not even a blade of grass that is beyond your joy. Hope not to be a snob on the very day love shows up in love's work clothes. Hope to see your own skin in the wood grains of your house. Hope to talk to trees and at last tell them everything you've always thought. Hope at the end, to enter the unknown, knowing yourself. forgetting yourself also. Hope to be consumed. Hope to be consumed. To disappear into your own love. Hope to know where you are. Paradise. If nobody else does. Hope that every failure is an arrow pointing toward enlightenment. And hope to sin only in the service of waking up.
Hi, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Andy. I'm the director of author events and the designated bad guy this evening. We have about 10 or 15 minutes to take some questions. If you have a question, please raise your hand and we will get a microphone to you. There's a gentleman in the back on the left with his hand up. Kim? Yes, sir.
I recently read a book, One Day in December, by Nancy Stout. You wrote the introduction for the book. It's a biography of Celia Sanchez. And in reading the book, I felt that her biography has a special relevance, especially to women in this country. And briefly, just to say that her life shows that it's possible for women to become leaders in a struggle to guarantee that everyone has top quality medical care, as well as education, as well as an attempt to eliminate poverty. So I wonder if you could just give a few words about why you decided to write the introduction to this book.
I'd be happy to. Celia Sanchez was really the equal partner with Fidel Castro in forming the Cuban Revolution, but nobody in this country hardly has heard of her. And so I get a lot of manuscripts and people asking me to, you know, read them, blurb them, write introductions. And I picked this one up and I started reading. It's about 400 pages long. It's so astonishing, this life of this woman who made the revolution with Fidel and Che and Camilo and, you know, the people that you, many of you in this audience, are somewhat familiar with. She was a society young woman. Her father was a doctor. And she, I think it was because he was a doctor, and she got to see some of what was going on to the people in her country. For instance, Cuba at that time was a place for a lot of rampant pedophilia. Brought in, the people who did it were brought in from the United States often, and or were members of the mob. And so they would come to Cuba and gamble and you know, avail themselves of prostitutes and of very small children, very young children. And one of these children was a child that Celia had known because of her work with her doctor father. And this child had been raped to death. And this was a turning point for her and for many of the women, like Heidi Santa Maria and Vilma Espín, all of these revolutionary women who took up arms were co-instigators of the Cuban Revolution to get rid of Batista, who was the dictator who was in the pocket of the United States. I read this through. I mean, it's just amazing. Nancy Stout, the writer, had access to the archives and all the letters between Celia and Fidel, for instance. And it is such an eye-opening read, because you understand that part of what, you know, we know so many of the reasons why we're kept in the dark about Cuba. But one of the big things that we had no idea about was just how strong the women's component was in that revolution. And so, because we were always shown just these men that, you know, basically had to be eradicated. And Celia herself lived to be 60, and she died of lung cancer. She was a terrible smoker. Her father before her was a smoker. He died of lung cancer. But I think she was always so stressed, because she was always trying to protect Fidel, who was always, you know, they tried to assassinate Fidel 648 times. And in the course of all those attempts, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, they're really an amazing people. Fidel and Celia adopted children. They adopted children of the people, some of the people who were killed making the revolution, and they raised them, even though, you know, half the time they were trying to find a place to hide him so that, you know, Hoover, whoever was looking, couldn't find him. One of the other fascinating aspects was that they were a revolutionary partnership. They never married. And Cuban society at that time, and I don't know about now, but it was very rigid and culturally about things like matrimony. You're supposed to be married. If you're going to be living with a man, you know, you have to be married. And so they were like, you know, when are you getting married? And so eventually Fidel apparently got around to feeling the heat and said, well, do you want to get married? And he apparently did this at least twice that we know of. And each time she said no. And what they ended up doing, what she ended up doing, basically, was every time he proposed marriage, she would build another room onto her house and fix it up really beautifully. I mean, she did this from the very beginning when they were in the Sierra Maestra. She was the person who made sure that up in the mountains he was comfortable, and he had his own room, you know, and she had her space. It's a really interesting something. It's a medicine. It definitely is. I mean, if you can. So anyway, so I read through this 400 pages, and it was so astonishing that I went right back to the beginning and I read it right through a second time, because, you know, this is how information is kept from us. You know, I mean, they put up an embargo. They tell you that the people are evil. They tell you, you know, blah 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 about why they're killing them. And you just have to find out for yourself. So I've been there 4 times, and I have always had a wonderful time, even in the period when there was practically no food, no gas, no nothing. I still felt that these were some great people, and I'm very happy for them that they have had so many people in leadership who truly loved them, who truly loved them. One day we will have somebody who truly loves us.
Carla, right here in the fifth row.
Hello, Mother Alice. How are you? I'm Carla Wiley. Oh, I'm sorry.
Hi.
Like Mama Sonia, I'm kind of close to the ground. I wanted to thank you for writing Everyday Youth. Your short story I use in the recovery community when I teach parenting about valuing our everyday things and valuing ourselves, and how parents can say no to their children in loving, still life-affirming and concerned ways. And I want to thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm. Gentleman right behind.
Thank you very, very much, Sister Alice, for your wonderful poems and inspiration. I love the furious dancing. I love the lessons that you teach in furious dancing, such as one about letting go of resent, and that being a lesson that I really need to learn. I will admit, and. So I just want to say I highly So just say I highly recommend it. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you.
We have time for one more question or testimony. Lady all the way in back. Is that you, Jamie? Keep your hand up.
I thank you for the paperclip moment. I doubt I'll look at a paperclip again. I doubt I'll look at a paperclip again and not value. Thank you.
And we say thank you to Alice Walker. Thank you for coming. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.